This week, 36 states in Washington, D.C. sued Google for antitrust violations, this time alleging the company abused its power over app developers through its Play Store on Android. It's the fourth such lawsuit brought against Google. We had President Biden signing a sweeping new executive order aimed at cracking down on anti-competitive behavior. We had our former President Donald Trump bring a lawsuit against Facebook, Google, and Twitter, alleging unfairness in how they regulate speech. So we have lots of stuff going on this issue. And with us to discuss this is Professor Daniel Crane. He's a distinguished professor of law at the University of Michigan, where he teaches, among other things, antitrust law and intellectual property law. He's the author of books, and he's a friend of the Karen Conti Show. Professor Crane, how are you? Thank you for joining me.
I'm very well, Karen. It's great to be back on your show.
So tell us a little bit about this new lawsuit that the states in Washington, D.C. Have brought against Google.
Sure. So Google's Play Store is the default app store for Android phones, but it's different than the Apple Store, where you can actually use a different a Play Store, like from Amazon or Samsung or someone else, if you want to. But lots of users on Android do use the Google Play Store. And Google has announced a policy that's taking effect in September to require that all app developers who use the Play Store pay a 30% commission on the sales of digital goods or services going through the Google App Store. And what the states allege, that that's an unlawful tying of the app to the financial transactions within the app.
So let's talk about tying, because that has kind of a legal connotation in the antitrust kind of world. Can you kind of break that down? What does that mean? And can you give an example of what an illegal tying arrangement is?
Sure. So tying has a long antitrust history. It goes really back to the beginning of antitrust law. And the idea is that when a company with a dominant position in product A forces customers to buy product B from it as well if they want to buy product A, that's an unlawful tie. So in the old days, for example, when IBM said, if you want to use our mainframe computers, you have to buy all of your punch cards from us as well, that was potentially an illegal tying arrangement, since IBM had a monopoly in the mainframe computers and potentially faced competition for punch cards, but required people who wanted to use its mainframe computers to buy all their punch cards from IBM as well. And by analogy here, the states are arguing that the Google Play Store is this dominant product that Google controls through Android, and it's forcing people who want to use a separate product, which is financial transactions, to buy apps to use Google financial services, basically by paying a 30% commission to Google as well.
Professor Crane, what do you think of this lawsuit? If the facts are as we see the facts, is this something that is problematic for Google?
Well, Google have many arguments against it, and right now there's a very similar case that just was culminated, and we're waiting for the decision involving Apple and its App Store brought by Epic Games against Apple. So we'll, you know, once we know the outcome of that case, we'll have a better sense of how this one's going to go. But I will so say that Google has lots of defenses. It will argue that it doesn't have market power in the Play Store because no one has to use the Android device to start with, or people can, even within Android, can switch to a different app store. It will also argue that there are legitimate reasons for customers who use the store to use Google financial services as well. In Google's mind, the store and transactions within the store are really one device. And if you start tearing them apart, there are implications for everything from data security to app functionality.
So we talked a little bit about some of these other lawsuits that the states have brought and different government entities have brought, trying to kind of allege that some of these, like Facebook, is sort of like a utility and should be regulated as such. Why do you think we're seeing so much of this kind of litigation from all over? And it's interesting, as we talked about before, that both the Democrats and Republicans finally have something to agree on, you know, and that is that that these companies have too much power and control in the market. And why are we seeing it now?
Yeah, I think it's kind of reached it where people sort of across the political spectrum feel threatened by the amount of power, especially that big tech has. although President Biden's executive order certainly goes well beyond big tech. But people have a sense that there is too much power being concentrated in too few hands, and that threatens competition, it threatens democratic values, it threatens fairness in a number of different ways. And so we're just seeing different manifestations of that feeling showing up in different sectors of the economy.
And, you know, again, part of our American way is to get good at something and make a product and a service that's really great and have everyone use it. But then it's sort of like they're getting punished for it. And, you know, there are other options out there. It's just that, you know, when you look at Facebook and when I was preparing for the show, I use Google. Of course I use Google. It's what you use. But I could just as easily put my default mode to Bing or something else. So as a search, you know, tool. But you know, how does that fly in the face of entrepreneurship and developing products and encouraging tech to grow in this country?
Sure. And this is very much what, you know, Apple would have been saying in the Epic trial, which is that the way they develop their app store is tied to the quality of the product that they offer. And that if you start messing with Apple's ability to be able to structure its app store in the way it prefers, then you're going to have a real problem in terms of the overall functionality of Apple's ability to develop its technology. So I'm sure Google will be saying the same thing in this lawsuit.
It's like it's a tightrope. You know, you improve and you make your product good and then you get punished for it. It's kind of, on the other hand, you understand you don't want a monopoly and you don't want some company to be controlling all kinds of things these days. It's not information. It's how people get their news. It's how people get buy their products and their groceries and everything. It's all consuming. And let's talk a little bit about the President Biden executive order before we go to break. There's like 72 initiatives in it. Some of these things seem to me to be like suggestions to various entities like the FTC type things. But let's talk about the first one. I wanted to just read a quote that President Biden said when he issued this executive order. He said, "Capitalism without competition isn't capitalism. It's exploitation. Without healthy competition, big players can change and charge whatever they want and treat you however they want. And for too many Americans, that means accepting a bad deal for things you can't go without." Let's talk about the one that kind of interests me, in that he says he's calling on the Federal Trade Commission to limit or eliminate non-compete agreements. And I think we all know what those are. But Professor Crane, can you just explain what a non-compete agreement is and how it works in the employment world?
Sure. So a non-compete agreement in an employment contract would typically say that the employee cannot compete against its employer for some period of time after it leaves the employment. So if you are a worker in a fast food restaurant, let's say, and there's a provision that says if you no longer work here at McDonald's, you can't work at any other fast food restaurant for 2 or 3 years after you leave, that's a non-compete agreement. Non-compete agreements could be in place in any kind of employment contract, from sort of low-skill sort of retail contracts up to the CEO of a tech company. And I think traditionally they would have been viewed very differently based on the kind of employer that was imposing that and the kinds of justifications that employer might have or not have for trying to limit its employee from competing once they leave employment.
And a lot of people don't know this, but they are enforceable. In Illinois, they're enforceable. But again, like you said, Professor, it has to be certain situations. So like lawyers can't enter into them. It's against public policy to try to limit lawyers because lawyers need to provide services to people. And the law wants to encourage lawyers to do that freely. But we kind of need what we call near permanent relationships, meaning that if an employer has a product that maybe these customers are long-term customers and it takes a lot of time to acquire these customers, and it's not like just a haircutting salon where someone comes in and out, but these are long-term relationships. At that point, that's when the law says, yeah, you can protect that. That's an asset, because what you don't want is to train somebody over a year period, get them used to your business, and then get poached by someone else. So when we come back, I want to discuss, how would this work? How would it be that the government can say all of those contracts out there with all of those employers now are null and void? Would that be something that will be subject to a lawsuit? We're talking to Professor Crane on the Karen Conti Show on WGN. We're here talking to Professor Daniel Crane about some of these lawsuits relating to competition. And I want to just finish up this conversation about non-compete clauses, because I think a lot of people out there may have them. So the example would be, let's say WGN said to me, listen, if you want to have a job doing radio, it's fine, but you have to sign your rights away so that when you leave the employment of WGN, you can't compete on another station. So President Biden signed an executive order that seems to kind of say maybe we should be getting rid of all of these non-competes so people can work more freely. Professor Crane, what do you think about that kind of law? Would that violate people's rights?
Well, there are lots of obstacles to this particular idea seeing the light of day. The first one is that the FTC is an independent commission, and President Biden can give it suggestions but can't give it orders, that they have to make up their own minds. Secondly, even assuming that the FTC or the Democratic majority on the commission wants to take this up, which they probably do, there's a real question as to whether they have the authority to enact substantive rules of this kind. They've almost never done that in their history, and there's a question about their legal authority to do that. And there are certain to be a wide variety of challenges, legal challenges, that would come about if they were to promulgate a rule of that nature, from that the commission doesn't have the authority to do this in the first instance, to the idea that there are constitutional limits, and also that this has traditionally been a province of the courts. I mean, the law of covenants not to compete in the English common law goes back to 1414. And so there's a very widely developed body of law about this, and one suspects that the courts might be a little uncomfortable with the FTC purporting to come in and sweep it all away by regulation.
Yeah, I just don't see that one as being something that's going to really work, because a lot of companies protect their assets and their trade secrets and their relationships and their pricing and all of that stuff through non-competes, and if those are not enforced, that could be a disaster for some companies. But let's go, there's his executive order goes through all different kinds of industries, and in the airline industry. Can you just talk a little bit about some of the suggestions he makes in this executive order relating to the airlines?
Sure. So there are a number of things that the Department of Transportation, and now unlike the Federal Trade Commission, the DOT is part of the executive branch, and so presumably they really need to follow the directions from the White House. But they're directed to look at a number of consumer issues with respect to airline transportation. So one of those is consumer access to airline flight information, so that consumers can more easily find a broader set of available flights, including by newer or lesser known airlines. And so the apparent idea there is that currently it's hard for consumers to easily access flight information for startups or smaller airlines, and the Department of Transportation is supposed to study that and come up with rulemakings or guidance to try to promote more competition with smaller or startup airlines for the benefit of consumers.
Interesting. And, you know, and there were some other things, too, about even just lost luggage. If you have lost luggage, there's, yep, you know, just things that kind of anger you as a traveler. And some of these suggestions to me sound very good. They're very pro-consumer. And he's basically nudging, in my view, from what I hear, is nudging the industry to kind of get a little more consumer oriented here so that people can go about their business and plan accordingly. Prescription drugs, you know, scrutinizing mergers and acquisitions more carefully, termination fees on cell phone contracts. I mean, all those types of things are among these initiatives in the executive order. And it'll be very interesting over the next few years to see whether these actually get made into law. But let's move to the lawsuit that former President Donald Trump filed this week. He has complained about censorship by the social media giants. He was kicked off of Facebook, I believe, still Twitter. But he sued Facebook, Google, Twitter, and other CEOs. What is this lawsuit about, Professor?
So it's a bit of a bizarre lawsuit to me, in the sense that what President Trump is arguing, or former President Trump is arguing, is that Google, Twitter, and Facebook are essentially state actors, and therefore they are subject to the First Amendment. It also seeks to invalidate Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, which President Trump had wanted to overrule by statute, but never got to doing that. And what Section 230 does is it shields the Internet platforms from liability for what's posted on their sites. So he wants to argue that's unconstitutional in the First Amendment as well. So it's really a class action. He's trying to bring a constitutional challenge to the way in which business is done basically on online platforms in terms of giving them lots of latitude and protection, and wants to say the Constitution holds them accountable. I'm quite skeptical that will be a successful lawsuit.
So this issue that... That say Google or Facebook is not responsible for things that people post on the site. So it's basically Facebook is a bulletin board, and we're not responsible for the people who post on the bulletin board. So he wants to get rid of that. To what end? What is the allegation there, that Facebook should be held responsible for what people say?
Right. So I think it's two things. One is Facebook is, if Facebook discriminates based on political perspective, that's like the government discriminating based on political perspective, and that would be unconstitutional. And also then if Facebook, censors content or disallows content of certain kinds, then Facebook could be liable for that. So it's really trying to turn up the screws on Facebook and Google and Twitter to make them accountable as sort of really a neutral platform that does not discriminate based on content.
And let's just, let's do the First Amendment 101, because I always feel like we need to do it, because people walk around saying, well, I have a First Amendment right to be on Facebook. We have a First Amendment right to do what we want to do. But First Amendment, as we know, Professor Crane, only applies to the government. So Facebook is not the government. And so Facebook can discriminate and say what it wants to have posted, right? I mean, pretty much.
That's right. That's a bizarre lawsuit, because I don't understand I understand the frustration, but I don't understand how you turn Facebook or Twitter into a government actor. They're private actors. And so the First Amendment does not apply to them. So unless this lawsuit really makes dramatically new doctrine, I just don't see where it's going.
Yeah. I'm going to skip ahead to this. The Texas Supreme Court, I think it was a couple weeks ago, ruled that Facebook cannot be sued for what people say on its site, but it can be held accountable for sex trafficking that occurs when recruiting is done through Facebook. Can you just explain, the basics of what is going on here? Because this is an interesting twist.
Yeah, so, at some level, it's a fairly technical decision about the Section 230 and, loopholes possibly for trafficking. So that's what holds at a narrow level. But more generally, it seems to be about a distinction between speech and conduct, which is to say Facebook does not have any obligation with respect to what's said on Facebook. But to the extent that a trafficking activity, a human trafficking activity, is happening through Facebook, that's a different issue. And Facebook does have an obligation to take action to prevent human trafficking from happening via the Facebook platform. And query how far that goes. It may be that there are other kinds of things which are also held to be conduct and not speech.
So would this same kind of rationale be used in the issue of terrorism? So let's just say that terrorists use Facebook to recruit and to do what terrorists do. Would that same kind of argument be used, that if someone is injured due to that terrorism, could they then sue Facebook for not preventing the terrorists from using Facebook as a platform to organize?
Yeah, I think it's a good possible extension of this case, which is, all right, maybe Facebook doesn't have any obligation to prevent hate speech or slander or libel, whatever, or false information. But to the extent that Facebook is being used actually to organize an activity, whether it's trafficking or terrorism, maybe there's some obligation.
Let's quickly just wrap up. I think when we talked last time, the NCAA Supreme Court decision had not come down. I don't think it had. But basically, the Supreme Court recently ruled that the schools can't be barred from giving college athletes certain educational benefits above and beyond tuition, like laptop computers and tutoring and things like that. And in reading the opinion, what do you think the Supreme Court is going to do in the future when we have the issue of whether college athletes should be paid?
Right. So the court's opinion itself is relatively narrow. As you said, Karen, it's really focused on invalidating NCAA rules to the extent that they limited player compensation to cover educationally related costs. Justice Kavanaugh's concurring opinion, though, goes much further and encourages the idea that at least some justices in the court view the whole NCAA system of limiting player compensation as a racket. And I think you're right that there will be further litigation in the lower courts. There's some litigation already pending. And I believe this issue may make its way back up to the Supreme Court at some point if Congress doesn't step in first to give guidance on whether the NCAA and its schools have an interest in maintaining amateurism by saying, okay, you can get compensated for all your educational expenses, but we're not going to have it, you know, have the Michigan quarterback or the Notre Dame quarterback, you know, being paid $3 million a year.
Yeah, having read that opinion, I think that we're moving more toward let's pay the athletes, because it just seems like the justices were kind of appalled all the money that is being made even by the coaches, and these kids are not making any of the millions and billions of dollars that's being generated. We're going to wrap this up. Professor Daniel Crane from University of Michigan, thank you as always for spending time on us and breaking this down for us. And I know you'll be back again when there are more lawsuits filed.
My pleasure, Karen. Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Take care.